Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today we're discussing healthcare in the United States, and my guest is Dr. Oliver Fine, Professor of Clinical Medicine and Clinical Public Health and Associate Dean at the Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City. Dr. Fine is also President of Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP, and immediate past President for the United States of the American Public Health Association. He also is a fellow of the American College of Physicians and serves on the Health Policy Committee of the Society of General Internal Medicine. He's also on the editorial board of the journal Medical Care. His recent writings include a chapter with Joanne Landy on the feasibility of fundamental health reform in the new book 10 Excellent Reasons for National Healthcare, published in 2008. Dr. Oliver Fine, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
So how long have you been practicing medicine in the United States, Dr. Fine?
That's probably about 30, almost 34 years.
And tell me what you feel is the state of medical care, particularly in your practice. Let's go from your practice to the general public. How does it operate within your practice with insurance policies and the like and hospital admissions? How does it operate now?
Well, essentially, the major problem that many of my patients face are the increasing amounts of what are called co-pays and deductibles. That means that even though they may have some form of health insurance, that they have to lay out of pocket money before that health insurance goes into effect, or that they may have to pay an additional amount of money for every visit that they do and every test that they take and every medication that they purchase. And that leads to some major expenditures for people. People who are insured in the United States, many of them are underinsured, but they don't really realize it until they try to use their insurance.
Well, what's the percentage of a bill? Say you saw a patient, you did a full clinical examination, spent an hour with them. What is the percentage that they have to put up front before their insurance kicks in?
It's totally variable. You understand that there are, up to 50 different insurance companies that my patients may have, and each insurance company probably has a different policy. For some patients, it's $10 a visit, $20 a visit. For other patients, depending on their policies, it can be up to $30 or $40 a visit. That's one of the major problems.
What about when they have to have special tests and CT scans and x-rays and all the rest? What about that?
Exactly. They can, in addition, end up having to pay a percentage of the test. So, a CT scan may be close to $1,000, and 10% of that, you can calculate it. It would be $100, right? Or it could be $200, or it could be $300.
And do your patients, do they complain about this, or is it sort of a given and they just take it on the chin, so to speak?
It's very, again, variable. Some patients, depends, I suppose, really on their personal incomes. And some can really afford it, and probably don't complain so much, but others, this is a real hit. And for them, it becomes, something that they do actually get concerned about.
Well, and then we can get on to drugs, of course. I mean, in Australia, we have a public health program whereby, you know, I'm on quite a few drugs because I've got a bit of heart disease, for instance, and I go to the chemist, and for all my drugs, it costs about $5. For people who have a condition such as that and are on many antihypertensives and anti-cholesterol drugs and the like, can you talk about the cost of drugs to these patients and how they cope?
Yeah, again, it's extremely variable. One example that is very interesting is, of course, the example of our Medicare program for people over 65. And the Republicans forced through a prescription drug benefit that unfortunately has what we call a donut hole in the middle of the benefit. That is to say, after a patient has paid about $2,500 for medications, then they are no longer insured until they pay up to $5,200.
Why on earth did the Republicans push that through? Was it to save money in the federal budget, or was it...
President Bush had just, you know, given tax relief, tax cuts to the wealthy, so that he had to put through a program that, because they didn't want to increase taxes, might in fact appear not to do that. And so that's why the donut hole was there. But this also fit a certain ideology of what people, call, we've got to make patients cost conscious.
Why? Well, I mean,
that they know what a medication costs, and this way they won't go out and use them frivolously.
Like they have to control their hypertension, or they might have a stroke or a cerebral hemorrhage, and that would be frivolous use of a drug?
Well, there is this whole attitude towards, medical care that patients, use it frivolously. Yeah, that they aren't aware of the cost of the care that they're getting, and therefore they overuse it. Now, the data really in this country totally, contradicts that. In the United States, we make the fewest visits per capita to a doctor.
Really?
Of the industrialized countries.
Really? I didn't know that.
We have the fewest number of days in the hospital per capita. It's absolutely astounding. But there is this notion that if you're insured, then you're going to overuse care, particularly if you don't know, if you don't share in the cost of care.
Does insurance then, Dr. Fine, pay for drugs as well?
Well, it depends, again, on the insurance that you have. The Medicare program up until 2003 didn't pay, interestingly, for medication.
Yeah.
But now they do pay for medication, but you can only get the coverage through a private insurance company. And in New York State, there are 50 different private insurance companies that cover prescription drugs. And what Medicare, as a purchaser, is not allowed to do is to negotiate directly with the pharmaceutical industry. And so what you have are inflated prices because the larger purchaser would be Medicare, but it can't directly bargain to bring prices down.
Well, who said they can't bargain? Is that a law passed by Congress?
That's part of the law. All the Medicare, prescription drug benefit has to go through a private insurance company.
That's ridiculous. And do you have any poor patients that you find just can't afford their necessary drugs, Dr. Fine?
yes, you know, the poorest patients are on Medicaid, which is our program, you know, for essentially patients who are in poverty. And there they have a small copayment, you know, usually below $5 per prescription. But there are other patients who, for instance, don't have insurance. It's very hard for me to see those patients in my practice because my practice is part of a large group affiliated to my medical center. And what happens is those patients are actually referred to the public hospital system, which I don't practice in, but interestingly, which my wife does. She's a pediatrician. So she sees many patients, you know, who don't have any insurance coverage, and yes, they have major problems with, you know, paying for care.
Do they get decent care in the public hospital system then, those people who fall between the cracks and have no health insurance?
Well, here in New York City, we have a very good public hospital system. And increasingly, I would say they do get reasonably good quality care. The one problem that they may end up with are these problems, for instance, with prescription drugs, but it's also possible in the public hospital system for these patients without insurance to get some subsidy. But New York is rather generous that way.
New York's unique.
If you were in Mississippi or Alabama
or Louisiana,
or Texas, you are really hurting. There's no question about
it. Well, I suppose, I mean, I can remember when I practiced medicine at Harvard Medical School at the Children's Hospital Medical Center, and I was treating cystic fibrosis patients, and this was when? It was in the 60s. And the parents would say they could not afford antibiotics for their dying children. I had never heard anything like that before, coming from Australia where our healthcare is free. And then I remember travelling next to a man in a plane once, and we got talking, and he said, "I'm not going to pay my taxes to look after your healthcare." I had never heard anything so incredibly selfish and arrogant.
Well, I don't think that's the prevalent feeling, you know, frankly, in the United States. I think that there is increasingly a feeling among the population that this isn't really fair, and that this does need to be changed.
Well, and Dr. Fine, I'm interviewing Dr. Fine, who's a professor of clinical medicine and public health associate dean at the Cornell Medical College. Dr. Fine, let's go right back to the beginning. How did this sort of nefarious process of insurance arise? When, what date, and before that, what happened to medical care in the United States?
Yeah, right. Well, I think that there are, you know, four periods of health insurance, you know, reform in the United States. There's the period before 1936 where really people just didn't have any formal health insurance. People paid for their care out of pocket. They bartered for care, brought a chicken to the doctor,
or cake.
An apple pie. And what changed and brought in the second period, which I say goes about 1936 to 1965, was the creation of an entity called Blue Cross. Blue Cross was a private insurance company, but it was nonprofit, and it only covered hospital care at that time. But it gave a vehicle through which unions began to bargain for fringe benefits. Then during World War II is what I call the accident of history, that health insurance gets linked to employment in the United States. Unions were not allowed to bargain, you know, for wages, but they were able to bargain for fringe benefits, and health care was one of those fringe benefits. And then the Internal Revenue Service, our taxing entity, came along and it said if the employer contributes something to pay for premiums for health insurance, the employer can deduct that from their taxes.
Oh,
and this
I
is
see.
What firmly married
oh,
health insurance
I didn't know that.
To employment in the United States. So we are, I think, the only industrialized nation where when you lose your job, you lose your health insurance.
Which is particularly scarifying now, right? When
that's right, particularly when you have 14,000 jobs being lost every day.
Every
in the
day?
United States today. That's the calculation that was made by the Labor Bureau just last
God
week.
God almighty. And
so 14,000 people losing their health insurance as well on a daily basis. So that's, you know, the period that I call employment-based health insurance.
Yes.
And then in 1965, what we began to see was a limited form of government health insurance. Medicare limited to people over 65. Mm. Medicaid limited to people with very low incomes, the poor. Mm. And the employment-based system, you know, persisted. And then in the late 1990s, we began to see really the rise of market-based health insurance. Nonprofit health insurers like Blue Cross converted to for-profit companies. And what you began to see was this, you know, competition among private health insurers to try to get rid of anybody who was sick. I mean,
how do you mean get rid of anyone who was sick?
And only insure the healthy.
You mean that you'd have a medical test to see if you're eligible for insurance, and if you've got anything wrong with you, you don't get it?
That's right. Particularly that happens if you are, you know, in what we call the individual market. The only way to get around that is, of course, to be employed by an employer who offers, you know, health insurance as a fringe benefit. But many, many employers during the 1990s and since 2000 have stopped, you know, offering health insurance. And that throws the individual into this individual market where the, you know, health insurance company can deny you a benefit if you've had a pre-existing condition. High blood pressure, cancer, diabetes. And this is their way of avoiding covering a sick person.
Well, that's wicked.
It is truly wicked. You're absolutely right. But that's where we are today. And it's one of the reasons why we in Physicians for a National Health Program really say we've got to move from this private health insurance-based system to what we call a one-payer or single-payer system that is run, you know, through usually government.
Okay, so let's stay with the insurance companies for a minute. You've got 50 of them in New York State, but they must be all over the country. How many in total are there of these health insurance companies?
Well, it's estimated that there are probably about 1,500 private health insurance companies throughout the United States.
And do they make a lot of money?
Actually, they do reasonably well in terms of their operating margins and their profit, yes.
Tell me about the influence they have in Congress.
Well, a substantial influence, right, which is one of the big problems. They are major contributors, you know, to many Congress people, both Democrats and Republicans, frankly. If you saw the movie Michael Moore made called Sicko, he actually outlines some of those political contributions to our congresspeople. And that certainly makes it hard to see a reform that would reduce their influence or actually eliminate their role in the health insurance system in the United States.
Yeah. How much does the United States now spend on health care and drugs per capita?
Per capita, it is now over $7,000 per person.
Per year?
Per year.
Compare that with other countries.
Well, if you look at, many of the Western European countries and your own, those countries are spending somewhere between $3,500 and $4,000 per capita.
Well, why is the American healthcare system so much more expensive when it's really rotten at its core in a way?
Yeah, well, partly that has to do with the fact that when you have all of these different insurance entities, it costs a great deal. They have high administrative costs and high profits. We calculate that about 30% of all healthcare dollars in the United States are spent on administrative expenditure.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, there has to be some administrative expenditure, but we could cut that in half down to 15% if we went to a single payer or, you know, publicly financed healthcare system, a one-payer system.
Why do you, I don't understand, we call it nationalized health here, and I think most Western countries do. Why do you call it single payer? I don't understand that term.
Well, because it, you know, simply means that rather than having multiple private health insurance payers,
yeah,
you're able to cut that down to a single payer.
Oh, it refers to who pays for the health care.
That's correct.
Not the individual.
It's not who delivers it, because the delivery system stays the same as it presently is.
Right.
You know, we do have a program that resembles single payer, and that's our Medicare program for the elderly.
Which works really well, right?
Which is fairly popular. It has its problems. It needs to be improved in many ways. Mm. You know, it certainly needs to be expanded to other ages in the population. But it's a pretty good program.
And how much does that cost per capita?
Well, it's also probably more than about $7,000 per capita, because, you know, what is the sickest segment of your population?
The old ones.
Yeah.
Like me.
And who else does Medicare cover? Under 65, people who are disabled permanently.
Yes.
And people who are on renal dialysis.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So the most expensive, you know, categories of patients are in the Medicare program, and therefore its costs are still above the per capita costs for the entire population.
Well, now, Dr. Fine, and I just would like to repeat that Dr. Fine is the president of Physicians for a National Health Program in the United States. Tell me how many of our colleagues would support this program. Is there a lot of passion around it within the medical profession?
Well, there's a growing passion. I will say that PNHP has, at this point, 15,000 members. That means that people are actually joining and, you know, paying dues and so forth. And that's a small segment of the physician population in the United States. But if you go out and you do a survey of physicians and you ask them, do you favor government involvement in the financing of the healthcare system, you find that really 59% of all physicians, practicing physicians in the United States, respond positively and say, yes, they do think that the only way is to have government involved. Mm. Now, it's not quite the same as saying that they favor a one-payer or a single-payer system, but that they actually see the importance of government involvement in the financing of health care.
Well, many of them must be pleased with the way Medicare functions. I mean, that's pretty smooth, isn't it?
There's, again, a wide variety of opinions about that. In some parts of the United States, Medicare doesn't pay as well as some of the commercial or private insurance companies in terms of, you know, what you would get for a visit to the doctor or what you would get to do an operation. And so some doctors have complained about Medicare not paying as much as some of the private insurers. On the other hand, the hassle is much less with Medicare. So I have been, for instance, in San Antonio, Texas, in the last year, and a cardiologist came up to me and said, you know, I have decided these private insurance companies keep denying my patients care. They won't let me get cardiac catheterizations on them when I think it's necessary.
Yeah,
I'm going to go and restrict my practice to Medicare patients only.
Yeah.
So there are some doctors who do feel that the hassles are less, and that that's worth, you know, getting a little bit less in terms of their fees than they get from the private insurance.
I know when I was practicing and my colleagues were in the States, you have to ring the insurance company in the middle of the night to ask if you can do thus and thus or form this procedure on a patient. You get a little girl at a switchboard looking at a computer. You know, it's so demeaning, demoralizing. I mean, we spend how many years training to become expert internists, for instance, and we've got these insurance companies telling us what we can and can't do to our patients, right?
Yeah, well, and it's quite clear that there is more bureaucratic hassle, denying of care and so forth in the United States than there is, again, I think, in virtually any other industrialized country.
And then I see little old ladies, you know, at a desk in maybe your hospital or wherever, and they've got a multitude of forms from this insurance company and that one, and they're all confused. They don't know what's going on. You know, it's a nightmare just bureaucratically and for these poor patients.
Absolutely. That's why we say going to, you know, a single payer or one payer system would save our about 15%. You know, we did a comparison of, you know, a hospital in Toronto General, with the Massachusetts General in Boston.
Yeah.
Toronto General has about three billers, you know, in their administrative structure. The Mass General has over 300 billers.
What do you mean by biller?
Somebody who's processing billings and claims, dealing with the denial of claims, sending them to all. See, every insurance company has a different form, a different procedure, you know, what they will cover, what they won't cover, which diagnoses they cover, and so forth. And you need staff to fill all that stuff out in order to get paid.
What a total shambles. Do you know, it reminds me of the design of nuclear power plants or nuclear reactors in your country. There are 104 of them, and every single one is of a different design. So there's no uniformity, and that can lead to lots of problems. And
absolutely. Now, both safety problems, I can imagine, in the nuclear reactor situation.
They're just accidents waiting to happen, which we won't get off on that track, but it's medical problem should it occur. The other thing I want to bring up is our profession. I mean, when I was 17 and entered medical school, I took the Hippocratic Oath. I never, ever thought about making money or earning money being a doctor. It never entered my head. I was kind of the Good Samaritan type doctor. And I remember when I graduated and we did locums and worked, you know, for various GPs when they went on holidays, my colleagues started talking about money, and it occurred to me that many of them had in fact done medicine so they could become wealthy, and some have become very wealthy. We are in fact an incredibly privileged sector of society, and I have thought about this pretty deeply, and I think in fact that teachers have a much greater responsibility towards society in general than do doctors, and I think that we are overpaid. Would you go along with that, Dr. Fine?
Well, what I would say is that, yes, I think today many students come into medical school with quite a bit of idealism.
Yeah.
The notion of being in a profession that provides service, being able to help people is very important. But what happens to many students in the United States today is that they end up with an enormous debt before they graduate.
How much does
the average debt from a private medical school in the United States is about $150,000 to $160,000. And so I think this shapes career choices. That students then decide to go into the more lucrative side of medicine in order to be able to pay back some of the debts that they have acquired. So that's one part of, you know, what's going on, frankly. But I still think that many people go into medicine, you know, frankly, because they want to help people.
Yeah. Well, you know, in Australia, when I did medicine, it was totally free. If you got certain grades at the end of school, you got a Commonwealth scholarship, and the whole of our medical school education was free. If we were poor, relatively, we got a living allowance, a book allowance. So we graduated with no debt. And that's the way it should be.
I think that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's something that we would like to see happen again and think would be more possible, you know, under a single-payer, you know.
So the single-payer, to get this straight again, the single-payer is the government.
Yes, that would be our notion, is that it would be...
Well, why don't you then be more direct and call it nationalized medicine? Like, you know, the Pentagon's nationalized, let's be frank, and they spend about $1 trillion of taxpayers' money a year.
I think the reason we don't do that is that there is, you know, a little bit of a bias in the United States against nationalizing anything.
Except for the Pentagon.
You're hearing it right today around the issue of nationalizing some of the big banks.
I know. It's pathetic.
President Obama doesn't use the word nationalize. He keeps away from that. The other thing that's very different from the Pentagon is that the Pentagon not only, uses tax money, but it employs, it's the government employing generals and soldiers and so on. We're not talking about the government employing, you know, doctors.
No.
We're actually talking about doctors remaining independent, negotiating their fees with government. Hospitals would not be owned by government in our proposal. They would continue to be run by local boards of trustees so that they respond to the local needs of the community in which they're located. So it is a little different. It really isn't like the, you know, National Health Service in the UK, where doctors are employed by government and where hospitals are owned by government. That's what I call truly socialized or nationalized medicine.
Yes. Well, in Australia, the doctors are not employed by the government, but, you know, I would go and see a doctor, have my, and then I'd pay my bill and walk next door to the Medicare office, and the money's handed back to me by the government in my hand, the cash. So the doctors are free and independent. There are some private hospitals, but the public hospitals are paid for by the state governments, actually. But they have their own boards. They're free to make their own decisions. So, you know, you don't have to think that the whole thing will be taken over. I think it would be good to look at that system because ours works pretty well here, although I have to say I think many of the specialists per se, like radiologists and dermatologists and the like, make too much money. And I think the people on the coalface of medicine, like family practitioners, general practitioners, they actually should be equally as well paid as the specialists.
Yeah,
would you agree with that?
I do agree with that. Being a general internist, and I think that is a major problem here in the United States today, is that we are probably down to about one third of all doctors in the country being primary care doctors, and two thirds are specialists. And that balance is just not good, I think, for patients or for the profession. And certainly one reason that this has developed is that there is a, you could call it overpayment of the specialist group of physicians, and certainly an underpayment of the primary care.
Yeah, well, that needs to be fixed too. So let's move on to the main issue then at hand. Well, you've got this question here, who favours single payer and who fights against single payer? We should address that first.
Okay, well, you know, the interesting thing is when you do a poll and the poll doesn't necessarily use the term single payer, but it says, you know, to the public, would you prefer the current system or a system like Medicare, that program for the elderly, run by government and financed by taxpayers? The answer is that anywhere is from 62 to 68% of Americans favor that kind of a system. Now, it may not be called single payer, but it certainly means that the public in general, I think, has a sympathy for this direction. Then if you go on and, you know, you look at business, okay, business is more ambivalent, although I think an increasing number of people in business are favoring moving toward a more single-payer, government-run, and finance system.
Egalitarian.
Yeah, right. And it's, you know, there is a poll in CFO Magazine, that's Chief Financial Officer Magazine, and what you see is that about 43% of Chief Financial Officers favor that kind of kind of system.
Yeah.
If we go to, you know, the faith community, for instance, the churches, in the last year, what we have found is that the Presbyterian Church, the Unitarian Church, their general assemblies have favored single-payer national health insurance.
Interesting.
Interesting. And then if you go to unions, there's, again, a little bit of a division among unions, but an increasing number of local unions are beginning to favor this. If we look at Central Labor Council's local union groups and look at their support for the one bill in Congress called H.R. 676, that is a single-payer bill, you're finding that over 450 local union groups are supporting that. And then just this past year, in June, the Council of Mayors of Cities in the United States was meeting in Florida, and they also came out in support of H.R. 676, House of Representatives Bill 676.
Okay, now, who's opposed?
So, who's opposed? Well, quite clearly the private health insurance industry. Okay, very potent. We talked about that before because they can contribute substantial amounts to political candidates.
Yep.
And the other group that seems quite opposed is the pharmaceutical industry.
Oh, of course.
And they're the ones that really engineered this situation with Medicare that doesn't allow the Medicare program to bargain directly with the pharmaceutical industry. Because if they did, the Medicare program would be able, I think, to bring drug prices down. In fact, I don't know if you know, but the entity in the United States that gets the lowest drug prices, can you guess what that would be?
No.
It's the Veterans Administration.
Oh.
Because they, in fact, have a large purchasing pool, so to speak.
Yep. Yep.
And they're able to bargain for the lowest prices.
I have to say, too, those drug companies, you've got a wicked... I've recounted this before. I interviewed Marcia Angel recently, who was the former editor of the New England Journal, and she's written a wonderful book on these drug companies. But I just want to recount a personal anecdote. I went to a CVS pharmacy recently to get about 20 sleeping pills, temazepam, for my jet lag. And I went to the counter and they said, that'll be $93. I said, what? And I said, I'd rather stay awake all night than pay for that. And I marched out of the shop and they said, well, you're lucky you got it cheaply. You're a doctor. I mean,
would
pay about $5 and it would cost a pharmaceutical company just a few cents to produce 20 of those, if that.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is absolutely obscene.
It is truly obscene.
Okay, so what are we going to do about it? I'll help you.
We have a lot of education to do.
Yes.
But I think that we need to be firm advocates for what we call a single payer. What we mean by that is a publicly funded
medical
national
system.
Health insurance program in the United States.
And drugs.
Which would include drugs, which would include long-term care, nursing home care, and home care for people.
Hospitals.
Would include hospitals, doctors, preventive care, dental care, and mental health care.
And eyes.
A comprehensive set of benefits.
Yes.
Right? And I would say that should be available to the entire population of the United States. We would say available to all residents in the United States. And you could define residency then as, you know, people who had lived here 3 months or 6 months or 9 months. This way we would deal with the difficult problem of immigration problems that we have in the United States. Because I believe we should also cover people who are immigrants.
Obviously, we should cover everyone. That's what our profession is.
Right. And there ought to be what we call automatic enrollment. So someone presents to the emergency room. They haven't gotten any kind of health insurance. Well, we just enroll them right there.
Of course.
Someone's admitted to the hospital and they don't have any kind of insurance. Well, we just enroll them there. Is there any private health insurance company that would enroll you when you were in the emergency room or when you were admitted to the hospital? No. And that's, again, one of the fundamental principles of a single-payer program is automatic enrollment.
Absolutely.
Comprehensive benefits. And, you know, essentially low administrative costs. We didn't talk about the exact numbers before, but Medicare, our one single-payer program in the United States, has an administrative cost of 3%.
Yeah.
That means that 97% of all dollars go to pay for doctors, hospitals, medications, and so forth, through taxing.
Compared with
private health insurance, which on the average has a 20% administrative cost and profit.
3% to 20%.
Right, so only 80% of all premium dollars collected by private insurers go to pay for doctors, hospitals, and medication.
When I wrote my book, If You Love This Planet, in 1992, I came upon an anecdote which occurred. You know, patients could not be admitted to a hospital because they were not adequately insured. And, you know, a guy who was terribly burnt died in the hospital parking lot of his burns, and someone else died of diabetic coma in the hospital parking lot. I mean, it's like a third world country. And other point to make is that we now cover patients seeing psychologists too, so their mental health is now covered as well.
Oh, well, that's great. I mean, that's been a strong movement in this country, is to get what we call mental health parity with physical health.
Yes.
That the reimbursement would really be similar. And in the past, there was a real discrimination against people who had mental health problems.
Which all of us do have at some stage or other in our lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
Depending on our grief and all sorts of things. Now, one last question. Tell us what you think the president, President Obama, is going to do about this whole situation, Dr. Fine.
We just had his speech before Congress last night, which said that, in which he said that healthcare reform was really still very much on the top of his agenda, and we think that's important that he's thinking that way, because, you know, there have been some problems with the resignation of Senator Daschle, and we all worried that that would set back the reform agenda.
Mm.
But it looks like he's going to push ahead on that, which is good. The question is, you know, what will he push ahead on? And regrettably, although in the past he was an advocate of single payer, he has essentially said that he would sign a law that had single payer, but I don't think he'll be the advocate for it. He views it as being too, I guess, partisan. And, you know, frankly, this past period has shown that even though he's tried to be quite bipartisan, bring in both Republicans and Democrats, he's been pretty unsuccessful with our stimulus package in doing that. So I regret that he's not actually pushing single payer, but that is where I think he stands at this point.
Do you think the health insurance companies got to him?
Well, I think
did
that
he receive
deeply,
money from?
They're deeply, involved with all these issues. I'm not sure I would say they literally got to him, but I think that what he is seeing is that the Republicans are going to be very strong defenders of the private health insurance industry.
Those Republicans are so out to lunch.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Now, one of the options that is going to be talked about is what's called a public option, that in the employer market, that people should be able to buy into you know, a Medicare-like public program.
Yes.
And if its administrative costs remain at 4%, it might be able to be offered cheaper than private health insurance, which has that 20% administrative cost.
Yes.
We're very interested in that alternative, but a little bit worried about it, because we know how good the private health insurance industry is at, again, risk selection, avoiding the sick and only covering the healthy.
Obscene.
One way they do this, interestingly, you might find this fascinating, they do this by offering a free health club membership. The private health insurance companies have done that. And I thought initially, well, that's great, because I'd like my patients to do more exercise and be involved with a health club. But then I thought about my sickest patients.
They can't go.
Mrs. Smith, who has congestive heart failure, she can't go.
No,
right?
No.
Mrs. Jones, who's got crippling arthritis.
Yes.
This is not going to be attractive to them. And so it leaves
yeah.
the really sick people in the public program.
It's a selection
and then what
process.
Will happen is the public program will cost more and more per patient. The private health insurance companies will cost less and less.
Yeah.
And there will be this very unfair competition between the two entities.
So, Dr. Fine, do you think most Democrats in Congress support your plan and the Republicans, obviously, for ideological and stupid reasons, oppose it? Is that generally how
well,
it would settle
down?
Well,
it's much more complicated than that because many of the Democrats are, you know, supporting programs that are not single-payer. We, in the last Congress, for this bill, H.R. 676,
yeah.
we had about 92 co-sponsors
yeah.
in the House.
Yeah.
Now, our House of Representatives has about 435
yeah.
members.
It's not enough.
No, not enough. That's right. And when you have a president who may not fully support this direction
yep.
at this time,
yep.
There are more Democrats that are wary about it. We have now, you know, each time you get a new Congress, you have to go back to get your co-sponsors. We've got over 50
so
co-sponsors
far.
Right now
yeah.
for H.R. 676.
Okay.
So that's good, but it's not quite enough.
Well, we have to mobilize the grassroots, don't we? So I've got two last questions for you. Do you
yeah.
have a web page that people can go to? And if there are any physicians listening to this program, I encourage you all to join. So what is your web page?
The web page is PN, as in Nelly, HP, PNHP,
.org. Okay. So,
and you, by the way, don't have to be a physician to join us.
Okay.
We have lower rates. For people who are not physicians, and it's a great source, pnhp.org.
So that's an order from us, two physicians. These are the doctor's orders. You've got to go to that webpage,
yeah.
read it, and also help support them financially. Now, the last question is, and I know from vast experience in the United States, that the only way to get the politicians to sit up and listen is to create a massive grassroots movement. How are you doing that, Dr. Fine?
Well, we're working together with all sorts of other groups.
Mm.
There is a group called Healthcare Now, which is a group of citizens and patients. There is the California Nurses Association, which is now actually merged with a group of other nurses. They are the largest nursing organization in the United States with over 150,000 members. They're very strong on single payer. We're working with union groups and also with the churches, as we described earlier.
Do you use television? Can you put ads on television? Because that's actually the most effective way to meet, to get to Mrs. Brown, you know, and Mr. Brown.
Well, ads on television in the United States are enormously expensive.
I know.
And depending again on the market, you know, the size
yeah.
of the television market.
Yeah.
So we did a few TV ads actually around the Iowa Democratic, caucuses, which were I think quite effective. But they are something that we can't quite afford at this point. We are, by the way, very available to local groups. So if there's a local group, a church group, a senior citizens
Good.
Organization, a union
Good.
That wants us to come and speak, go to pnhp.org.
And the other thing that you need to do, and your colleagues, I would suggest, is get yourself on the talk shows like Oprah and all of the rest. Because
we're doing that as much
way.
As we can.
Yep.
Yep, I was on a talk show just last week
at
6:45 in the morning.
And, you know, there's always a bit of sort of theatre in it, so you could wear your white coat and your stethoscope casually draped around your neck, you know.
Uh-huh.
I'm just joking, but people like that. And last thing I'd like to say, Dr. Fine, is that if there's anything I can do, because I come to the States quite often for speaking trips, to help, support, encourage or recruit new people, can you please keep me in the loop and tell me what you'd like me to do?
Absolutely. This is wonderful to meet you over the wires here. And definitely, if you're in the United States, we should be in touch.
Well, I thank you very much for such an edifying, lucid discussion of healthcare in the United States. I wish you all the best of luck. And it's really just following the Hippocratic Oath, is it not?
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Fine.
All the best. Stay well.
You too. My guest on If You Love This Planet today was Dr. Oliver Fine, Professor of Clinical Medicine and Clinical Public Health at the Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City. Dr. Fine is also President of Physicians for National Health Program, and you can find them on pnhp.org, pnhp.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk together next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.